This is the second day of this January 2012 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. And we'll resume reading from our text from yesterday. It's the teachings of the 17th century Japanese Zen master Bankei. And we're reading from a book called Bankei Zen, Translations from the Record of Bankei. This is translated by Peter Haskell. Now this, yesterday we read about his life, and today we'll start in on the actual talks. The section of the book is called Sermons, which was a word I hope never escapes my mouth in relation to Zen. Dharma talks or teishos, but not sermons, please. Yesterday we read of how at the age of 68 he opened this big extended, the Japanese call it kessei, a training period where there were, well, that's where these talks were taken from. So just as an introduction, this is what the record reads as a translation from the Japanese. When the Zen master Bankei Butsu Kosai, founder of the Ryomonji at Aboshi in Banshu, was at the great training period held at the Ryomonji in the winter of the third year of Genroku, at 1690, there were 1,683 monks listed in the temple register. Those who attended included not only Soto and Rinzai followers, but members of the Ritsu, Shingon, Tendai, Pure Land, True Pure Land, and Nichiren schools. These are all, of course, different schools of Buddhism. The first one, Ritsu, is the Japanese word for the Vinaya, the school that from ancient times studied the monastic rules and regulations. With laymen and monks mingled together, thronging round the lecture seat. And then this little flourish. One sensed the master was truly the teacher of men and devas for the present age. At that time, the master mounted the lecture seat and addressed this assembly of monks and laymen, saying, "We've you hear the quite informal tone, colloquial language that Bankei uses, assuming that the translator was accurate. "We've got a big crowd of both monks and laymen here at this meeting, and I thought I'd tell you about how, when I was young, I struck on the realization that the mind is unborn. This part about the mind, though, is something secondary. You monks, when you abide only in the unborn, will find that in the unborn, there's nothing anyone needs to tell you, nothing you need to hear." Well, if we understand this abiding in the unborn as this state of luminous awareness that we often refer to as samadhi, then anyone who's been in this state, even briefly, can appreciate when Bankei says, "There's nothing anyone needs to tell you, nothing you need to hear. It's all fully revealed. Complete. Settled." He goes on, because the Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating, it gets easily turned into whatever comes along. So as long as I'm telling the lay people here not to change themselves into these different things that come their way and trade their Buddha mind for thoughts, you monks may as well listen too. It almost sounds like he's saying that, well, the monks, you don't need to hear this so much. This is for lay people, but all right, come along. I don't know how he could think that. He's been in monastic life long enough to know that it's really fundamentally no difference in how we misuse our minds, whether lay or monk. The master addressed the assembly. Among all you people here today, there's not a single one who's an unenlightened being. There. That's how he opens his talk. That's how Hakuin opens his chant and praise of Zazen. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. Among you people here today, there's not a single one who's an unenlightened being. Everyone here is a Buddha. So listen carefully. What you all have from your parents innately is the unborn Buddha mind alone. There's nothing else you have innately. This Buddha mind you have from your parents innately is truly unborn and marvelously illuminating. Unborn, again, as we said yesterday, unborn really means that it is beyond time. It's beyond birth. It's beyond death. That you can't put beginnings or endings on this Buddha mind. It just is. It just is. We don't say that each day the sky, the blue sky, is born again. It just is. So is this Buddha mind that we all share. He goes on, that which is unborn is the Buddha mind. The Buddha mind is unborn and marvelously illuminating, and what's more, with this unborn, everything is perfectly managed. The actual proof of this unborn, which perfectly manages everything, is that as you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, if out back there's the cawing of crows, the chirping of sparrows, or the rustling of the wind, even though you're not deliberately trying to hear each of these sounds, you recognize and distinguish each one. The voices of the crows and sparrows, the rustling of the wind, you hear them without making any mistake about them, and that's what's called hearing with the unborn. In this way, all things are perfectly managed with the unborn. He's talking, of course, about direct experience. This direct experience that is beyond learning, beyond having to learn anything. This is our natural state. There's a koan in the Mumon Kan, Sozan and Poor Seize, where a monk by the name of Seize comes before the master Sozan. And he says, I'm poor and alone, I beg you to make me rich. Sozan said, Venerable Seize, yes, sir? You've drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China and say that your lips have not been moistened. How did that monk drink those 3 cups of wine? How did you drink those 3 cups of wine? cup overfloweth. Or as Roshi Kapoor used to love to add, our cup overfloweth and sloppeth on the floor. Bhanke continues, well then, while you're all turned this way, listening to me talk, you won't mistake the chirp of a sparrow out back for the caw of a crow, the sound of a gong for that of a drum, a man's voice for a woman's, an adult's voice for a child's. You clearly recognize and distinguish each sound you hear without making any mistake. That's the marvelously illuminating dynamic function. It's none other than the Buddha mind, unborn and marvelously illuminating. We don't want to take this too literally. There are times, and of course we could mistake two sounds for another. I mean, you could hear a high-pitched man's voice and mistake it for a woman's, or vice versa. We know that during sesshin, we can sometimes mistake one sound for another. Waiting in the Doksan line and hearing the Yinking bell here in the Zendo to end around, and thinking it's the teacher's handbell, and in Doksan, after I ring my handbell, I often think that I hear the student's response, but often they haven't responded. So I've just learned that if I'm in, and if there's any doubt in my mind, then I just signal the student with that green bulb, and often, yeah, it turns out they didn't hit the bell yet, but sometimes they already did. Things get mixed up in sesshin: sounds, sights, hallucinations, little hallucinations now and then. This is a very normal part of the sesshin experience. In our mind, we are getting beyond the ordinary time-space structure of the mind, extending our awareness beyond that, then things can get kind of muddled at times. He goes on, wondering, what's Bhanke telling us? All of you are turned this way, intent only on hearing what I'm saying. No one's deliberately trying to hear the various sounds coming from out back. That's why, when all of a sudden these sounds appear and you recognize and distinguish them, hearing them without any mistake, you're hearing with the unborn Buddha mind. Nobody here can claim he heard these sounds because he'd made up his mind beforehand to listen for them when they were made. So, in fact, you're listening with the unborn. So, in other words, it's beyond this natural functioning of our senses, which really means our mind, our true mind. This functioning is beyond intention. We don't have to intend. They have these senses have a life of their own. He goes on, everyone who conclusively realizes that what is unborn and marvelously illuminating is truly the Buddha mind is a living Tathagata from today forever after. Tathagata is just a formal way of referring in the text to a Buddha. Everyone is a living Tathagata from today forever after. Even Buddha is just a name given to traces that have arisen. So from the standpoint of the unborn, it's only a secondary matter, a peripheral concern. It's a famous saying in Zen, If you utter the word Buddha, we should wash out your mouth with soap for 3 days. I think a more contemporary version of that is if you utter the word enlightenment, you should wash out your mouth for 3 days with soap. Why talk about Buddha when everything is Buddha? There's nothing that is not Buddha. Why talk about enlightenment when there is no one who has ever, ever not been enlightened? Well, an answer to that question, that rhetorical question, is because it has some usefulness in distinguishing the enlightenment experience from when one hasn't had an awakening. But this is where words are so treacherous, because then we start to think, we start to believe that there are people who are fundamentally enlightened and others who are not. He goes on, the person of the unborn abides at the source of all Buddhas. What is this source? In the theistic tradition, a troubling question that has lasted for millennia is, if God made everything, what made God? Or there's a koan where the monk says to the master, if all things return to the one, what does the one return to? Again, the person of the unborn abides at the source of all Buddhas. That which is unborn is the source of all things, the starting point of all things. There's nothing more original than the unborn, nothing prior to it. You can imagine how thinking takes us away from this unborn, because just to conceive of a time before this Buddha mind is to divide time. This is the function of the discriminating mind, which also has its uses, but as soon as we lapse into discrimination, then we are apart from this unborn, although that's not true either. We can't ever remove ourselves from this unborn Buddha mind, but we lose sight of it. He goes on, there's no question of perishing here, so when you abide in the unborn, it's superfluous to speak about the imperishable too, or the indestructible. It's just the flip side of the unborn. That's the reason I only talk about the unborn and don't mention the imperishable. What isn't created can't be destroyed. So since it's unborn, it's obvious it's imperishable without having to mention it. Isn't that so? When you abide in the unborn, you're abiding at the source of all things. What the Buddhas of the past realized was the unborn Buddha mind. And what Buddhas in the future will realize is the unborn Buddha mind. We today are living in the degenerate age of Buddhism, yet when there's even one person who abides in the unborn, the true teaching has been restored to the world. There's a footnote here for this, the degenerate age of Buddhism. For those of you who haven't heard this before, let me read this. It comes up in texts, and so everyone should have some familiarity with this idea. The footnote reads, according to certain Buddhist theories, the history of the Dharma, the Buddhist teaching, is divided into three periods. In the first, the period of the true teaching following the Buddha's death, the Dharma is perfectly upheld in all respects. In the second, the period of the approximate teaching, only the outward forms of the Dharma are maintained. People practice, but no longer have the capacity to realize enlightenment. In the last, the degenerate period of the teaching, which includes the present age, neither practice nor enlightenment remain, but only the teaching itself. There are different calculations for the length of each period. Generally, the first is said to last 500 years, the second 500, 2,000 years, and the last 10,000. Blah, blah, blah. We know this is... Maybe if what enlightenment means, you know, perfect enlightenment, that's maybe there's something to that, who knows. But it's the last thing anyone wants to be troubling themselves with, is whether this is the degenerate age of Buddhism. I never understood why this is such a persistent notion in Buddhist texts, because in terms of practice, what good can it do you to be thinking that, you know, we're just winding down here and there's no enlightenment that's possible? But I felt obliged to mention it because, you know, it's just for a little bit of educational thing. But here, Bhante isn't buying this. We today are living in degenerate age Buddhism, yet when there's even one person who abides in the unborn, the true teaching has been restored to the world. All of you, isn't it so? It certainly is. When you've conclusively realized this, then and there, you'll open the eye that sees into people's minds, and that's why my school is called the Clear-Eyed School. When the eye that sees into people is manifested, whenever it happens to be, that moment is the complete realization of the Dharma. I want you to know this. Whoever you may be, at that moment, you are my heir. Again, he's saying that this is our nature. This Buddha mind is our nature, our Buddha nature. And all we have to do is to actualize it. To abide in this realm of the timeless that goes beyond all coming and going. And there it is. Here's a little story. Bhante speaking. A certain teacher of Buddhism told me, instead of teaching the same old thing in your talks day after day, you ought to throw in a few Buddhist miracle stories once in a while and give people a refreshing change of pace. Actually, the teacher may be onto something. Instead of teaching the same old thing in your talks, there is a repetitiveness to Bhante's teaching that I think goes beyond even the normal repetitiveness that is part of good teaching. Part of good teaching is repetition, to hammer these truths into our minds. So there's that with every teacher. But here there is a repetitive quality that forces me to skip around quite a bit so as not to keep saying the same thing. Anyway, why don't you throw in a few Buddhist miracle stories? And now Bhante says, of course he might be right. I may be thick-headed, but we already heard that he was, with the stone throwing and everything. But provided something is really helpful to people, then, thick-headed or not, I'm not beyond memorizing one or two old stories if I put my mind to it. However, teaching this sort of thing is like feeding poison to sentient beings. And feeding people poison is something I certainly can't do. Yeah, stories are one thing. They're wonderful at the right time, the right kind of story. But miracle stories, I'm with Bonke on this. Why do we need miracles? Or isn't this miracle enough? This, here we are. I'm talking, you're listening. The sun is in the sky. The blood is coursing through our veins. The breath filling our lungs and exhaling. Walt Whitman is supposed to have said, one flea is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. Can we bring that perspective, that seeing every single thing, every single person, every single creature, for the miracle that she or he or it is? Well, we can't just will it, but through Zazen, through long, persistent Zazen, the mind becomes cleaned, freshened. So this is the kind of vision we acquire through long sitting. Not even acquire, it's restored. This vision of seeing the wondrousness of every single thing and every creature. This comes on its own, but it comes at a price. We have to do the work. We have to stick with it. Here's another talk. What everyone has from his parents innately is the Buddha mind alone. But since your parents themselves fail to realize this, you become deluded too, and then display this delusion in raising your own children. Everyone involved in bringing up children display every sort of deluded behavior, including stupidity, selfish desire, and the anger of fighting demons. These are the three, what we call the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion. Growing up with deluded people surrounding them, children develop a first-rate set of bad habits, becoming quite proficient at being deluded themselves and turning into unenlightened beings. Originally, when you're born, you're without delusion. But on account of the faults of the people who raise you, someone abiding in the Buddha mind is turned into a first-rate, unenlightened being. This is something I'm sure you all know from your own experience. Nervous laughter. What Bonke could not have known is the great advances of science in the field of genetics. And that there is a genetic component to a child's psyche that figures in there. But still, he goes on, your parents didn't give you any delusions whatever when you were born. No bad habits, no selfish desires. But afterward, once you'd come into the world, you picked up all different sorts of delusions, which then developed into bad habits so that you couldn't help becoming deluded. That which you didn't pick up from outside is the unborn Buddha mind, and here no delusions exist. Since the Buddha mind is marvelously illuminating, you're able to learn things, even to the point of thoroughly learning all sorts of deluded behavior. At the same time, since it's marvelously illuminating, when you hear this, you'll resolve not to be deluded, and from today on, cease creating delusion, abiding in the unborn Buddha mind as it is. Just as before you applied yourself skillfully to picking up delusions and made yourself deluded, now you use the same skill to listen to this and stop being deluded. That's what a splendid thing the Buddha mind is. Listen and you'll realize the preciousness of Buddha mind. Then, since there's nothing that can take the place of this precious Buddha mind, even if you want to be deluded, you won't be able to be anymore. It's because you don't realize the preciousness of Buddha mind that you indulge in self-centeredness, creating delusions that do you harm. Yet those delusions are so precious to you that all of you actually want to become deluded, even at the risk of your own life. Foolish, isn't it? Unable to withstand the base impulses produced by your selfish desires, you become deluded. With all delusions, it's the same. So let's think of a couple. Yet those delusions are so precious to you. Well, of course, the most precious thing in the world to us is this sense of self. That's the delusion of all delusions. And we will cling to this sense of self. We will defend it endlessly. But then beyond that, there are notions, deep-seated, deeply ingrained notions in the mind that are somehow important to us that we do cling to. Why do we cling so tenaciously to these notions about self and other and the world, the way things are? I believe it's because there is the fear of not having anything in the mind. An empty mind can be frightening at first. We fear the void. And so we keep these ideas, these concepts packed into the mind, and we hang on to them for dear life. They're so important to us that we can't be expected to just make up our mind and let go of them. Instead, we have this practice of zazen, of sitting, that enables these things enables us to get free of these notions. It sort of happens in spite of us, this loosening and dissolving of our mental attachments. If we had to just summon up the will to let go, whatever that means, let go of our belief in a self, a separate self, it would be hopeless. But we have the ultimate method, which is just this ground of practice where these things, little by little, usually, sometimes in chunks, but little by little, these concepts that we cling to so tenaciously start to lose their grasp. They're pried out of our clutching fingers of our mind. He goes on. Everyone insists that the way he likes to behave is his innate character, so he can't do anything about it. He'll never tell you how, actually, he indulges in self-centeredness because of his selfish desires, holding on to those kinds of behavior he likes. Instead, he tries to sound clever and talk about how it's all innate. And there's another major delusion that we cling to. Oh, this is me. This is the way I am. This is the way I've always been. This is how I'll always be. It's my character. Character can be misunderstood. There is a continuity to character, of course. We all know that. You don't just change character overnight. But it is only relatively continuous. We know that we can, this what we call character, certainly personality, can change little by little. But to think, it can be turned into a kind of a sense of ego. This is my character that I'm stuck with. There's nothing permanent. There's no permanent self. There's no permanent character in any absolute sense. It's a fiction. It's a chimera. It's a notion. He goes on, to falsely accuse your own parents of something you never got from them is terribly unfilial. Is there anyone who's born a drunkard, a gambler, or a thief, who's born with any sort of vice? No one's born that way. Once you pick up a taste for liquor, it promptly develops into a drinking habit, and then, because of selfish desire, you find yourself unable to stop without realizing you've become deluded. It's only foolishness, so you've no cause to claim it's innate and pass off the blame on your parents. It's a real turning point in one's evolution when you realize that, yes, your parents were not perfect. Maybe they were far from perfect. Maybe they were abusive and they were all kinds of things. But it's not enough just to blame them. They had their responsibility for the afflictions we acquired, but now the buck stops here. We don't need to keep blaming others. This is what we have to work with. We can't change them. We change ourselves. Another talk. Everyone, do exactly as I'm telling you, and following my instructions, start by trying to abide in the unborn for 30 days. Learn to abide in the unborn for 30 days, and from there on, even if you don't want to, you'll just naturally have to abide in the unborn. You'll be a success at abiding in the unborn. Since that which is unborn is the Buddha mind, you'll be functioning with the Buddha mind at all times. That way, you'll be living Buddhas here today, won't you? So listen to my teaching just as if today you were all born anew and starting afresh. When you've got some fixed notion, you won't take in what you hear. Listen as if you were newly born right now, and it'll be like hearing my teaching for the first time. If you don't have any fixed notion in your mind, at a single word you'll instantly understand and attain complete realization of the Dharma. Oh, this is the ideal of listening to the Dharma, whether in Teisho or anywhere else, is to hear it as if for the first time. How do you do that, practically speaking? Well, if your practice while you're sitting is a breath practice, then when you're listening to Teisho or any encouragement talk, let's say, then you just notice when thoughts are in the way and let go of them. It's the noticing. Notice when the mind is wandering and get more thoroughly into just listening. If your practice is a koan, then you will find that after a while you can actually listen to what is being said with the awareness of the koan in the back of the mind. And this awareness of the koan, at least to a degree, keeps us free of these thoughts that get in the way of just pure listening. If you find that you can't listen and have any kind of awareness of the koan at the same time, then during Teisho talks, just let go of the koan for that whatever, 5 minutes or an hour or whatever, and then return to it afterward. Here's one about mind reading. This is a question I sometimes get. The questioner at this great assembly, he says to Banke, "Everybody says your reverence has the power to read people's minds. Is it true?" The master said, "In my school, we don't have such extraordinary things. And even if we did, since the Buddha mind is unborn, we wouldn't use them. When I'm speaking to you, I deal with your own selves. So you imagine I've got the power to read people's minds. But I haven't any mind-reading powers. I'm just the same as all of you. When you abide in the unborn, you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas. And without even having to seek supernatural power, all things are perfectly managed and smoothly dealt with. In the true teaching of the unborn, you can manage everything by dealing with your own self without bringing in all sorts of extraneous matters." This is a pure Zen kind of response. Having no truck with psychic powers, certainly not trying to cultivate them. They may come up at times, but not to try to do anything with them. When he says you're at the source of the supernatural powers of all the Buddhas, he's referring to sort of part of Buddhist teaching that the great enlightened ones have these supernatural powers. But he's warning us not to get lost in those kind of thoughts, but just be here fully now, full presence. It's really what he's talking about when he says, when he keeps referring to the unborn Buddha mind. We could just plug in there. Instead of that, we could just say, full presence. Here. Nowhere else. Justice. We'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.